on This Is Vinyl Tap.
Attention, adults. You need help. Mother, are you depressed because your fabric softener has been hardening on you lately? Dad, are you despondent because your stock slipped 14 points in one day? If so, stop worrying. Help is on the way.
Help! I need somebody. Help! Not just anybody. Help! You know I need someone. Help! When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
100!
Ladies and gentlemen, we have hit episode 100. Let me go into a few details on that. That means this is our 100th album.
Yeah, review.
Yes, right.
We've reviewed. And I don't even like saying the word review because...
Disgust.
Most of the people who review albums suck. Anyway, we're going to do something special tonight, fellas.
Yes, we are.
We've been talking about it for...
Mm-hmm. We've like been ever. Trying to decide the appropriate way to celebrate the 100th episode, and we decided that the best way to celebrate the 100th episode is to talk about an album from the greatest rock and roll band ever. And shut up if you think you're going to say someone else. There's just one greatest rock and roll band ever.
Yeah.
And if you think it's someone else, write a little thing about it and then send it to your cousin.
This is Vinyl Tap, and we're broadcasting our 100th episode from the Vinegaroon Saloon, appropriately enough.
That's right. And that was Jonathan J.M. Rowe, who became frustrated with his host not getting the basics taken care of. And also with me tonight in the Vinegaroon Saloon is T, otherwise known as Tony. Tony?
Yes, sir.
Do you like the Beatles?
Do I like the Beatles? Yes, I like the Beatles very muchly.
I think that most of our listeners at this point know which album we chose.
They may wonder why we picked it, though.
I was going to go into that. So I've got two very good assistants helping me host tonight. T?
Yeah.
Why did we choose Help with an explanation point?
Yeah, and we'll get into that as well. I wanted to talk about it, and I assumed this was one of the reasons. We always pick albums that have a little bit of something about them. And when you're talking about the Beatles, it's like, okay, what album? This is an album that I think is significantly underrated in their catalog. It also, there's a whole lot of firsts involved in this album, a bunch, and we'll talk about them as we get going. It's also, I think, consensus-wise, although maybe not among the three of us, the last album of their, what's called their early period. There's typically three periods of the Beatles, early, middle, and late period. And this is either the first album of their middle period that some people in this room might say.
That's not me. I was quoting other people. Oh, I don't care. Okay.
Or it's the last album of their early period. And the reason why I do care is because I think there's a shift after this album. This album has glimpses of what's to come.
It's a transitional album, I think.
Okay, that brings me to my first question.
Okay.
First of all, I don't care if it's the middle or the first. I separate Beatles albums into the I, Me, You category and the post-I, Me, You category. And what I mean by that is the from the beginning to this album, the songs are I, me, you focused. I need you.
Oh, I
you've
see
got
what you're
to
saying.
Hide your love away. You like me too much. I've just seen a face.
Yeah.
And if you go backwards, it's I want to hold your hand.
Yeah.
It's all that kind of. And then Rubber Soul is. But my question is, which Beatles album is the least transitional album? Because everybody likes to talk about what a big transition this or that album was.
The least transitional album? What is? I don't understand that question.
Okay. I think I understand the
question.
Well,
why don't you answer it and the slow people can
magical
catch up.
Mystery tour.
I was going to say that if I understood the question, I was going to say that as well.
You think they
I think
stayed put?
They stayed pretty put.
They were treading water on
well,
that one.
That's yeah. a difficult album because it's not really
an album.
Because it's got, as an album, it's got Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane on it, which were recorded before Sgt. Pepper
right.
And then all the songs single. After it. But you're right. I mean, that single...
There was room for that, those songs on Sgt. Pepper.
There were.
There was so much
room. There was. Yeah. There was. But so you've got those songs, which are very Sgt. Pepper-y. Then you got Sgt. Pepper's, and you got Magical Mystery Tour, which is also very Sgt. Pepper-y. So I agree with JM. I think that Magical Mystery Tour is
the least. What's the most transitional?
Let It Be.
I can see that.
Because they're transitioning into non-existence?
No, because they went from what they had been doing before. They went back to it.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a significant shift in their musical style at that point.
I'm so distracted by the producer and murderer in charge of that record.
Oh. I'm not even talking about that. You can buy Let It Be Naked and take all his
it's right over there.
Nonsense off of it.
I used to have a CD player that worked until about 30 minutes ago.
But it still has that, it still sounds...
You think it sounds like they went back to something earlier.
I think, and they did. Like they did one after 909 is one of the first songs they wrote together, right? So
what's the most transitional?
I gotta say, Sgt. Pepper's. I because there's so many reasons why I think Sgt. Pepper's is the most transitional, and one of them is it was the packaging. It was the first one where the United States release and the English
were the same. First album with lyrics, I believe.
First
printed
on the
sleeve. What he means is the album cover had lyrics on top of the photos.
Yeah,
which people
never had done really before.
No, and even I am too young to notice that.
You know what I think's also why that's a good pick is because it's at the point where there's a significant departure between what McCartney was writing and focusing on and what Lennon was writing.
I agree with you on that.
And
McCartney becomes. The McCarthy Project.
Well, I got it. Yeah, we'll talk about this when we talk about.
Now, why didn't y'all say Revolver? Because to me, everything in Sgt. Pepper showed its head in Revolver.
I think it showed its head, but the songs became No songs go bleed into the next one. They do that all over the place in Sgt. Pepper's. The studio techniques were, even though they were, backward. Guitar solos and just weird stuff like with backward tape loops and all that kind of stuff happened on Revolver. Everything just to crystallized on Sgt. Pepper's.
Did Revolver have an 8-track or is Sgt. Pepper's the first one with the 8-track?
I don't think Sgt. Pepper was even 8-track. I think White Album was the first one with an 8-track.
So the other thing I think that's interesting about the two, if you want to talk about them in comparison, is... Revolver, here's a question for you, Doug. Name the best Lennon song on Sgt. Pepper.
He gets half a day of the life.
Okay, that's probably the best thing that band ever did. But
yeah,
if you think about that album, it's a McCartney album. I mean, it's a McCartney album with some Lennon songs on it.
Well,
Revolver is much more of an even album.
It's like this one.
Yeah. But
no, I agree that. Sgt. Pepper is where Paul takes the reins, and I don't know the story about how that happens, but you know that it's true when you hear John talk about Sgt. Pepper. Actually, everybody I watched, I watched them all interviewed about their favorite and least favorite album. A lot of them don't like Sgt. Pepper. And it's mostly because they quit being a band on that album.
So, yeah, and to be honest with you, and we'll hit that a little bit, that starts to show its ugly head on this album.
Well, yeah, it does.
It does.
We'll get there in about 13 songs.
It is 13, you're right. Yeah. Which is where the album probably should have stopped.
I'm not going to disagree with you there either.
I'm gonna share something with the audience. I did what we call a On the Record. It's our new feature, ladies and gentlemen, called On the Record. And that's when the host, me, forces the other guys to answer questions so that we can see how much we agree or disagree on certain things. And I'm going to go through Jonathan J. M. Rowe first.
They're probably shorter than mine.
Much shorter, I'm sure.
Where does the album Help rank among the Beatles albums? Jonathan J. M. Rowe, tell us your answer.
I think that I said that it was the second best of the period. I thought that Rubber Soul was the...
You put Rubber Soul above it in the
first half.
And I assume that Sgt. Pepper gets to be better than Rubber Soul.
Yes. And... Yes, but I kind of divide. I make the division after Rubber Soul.
So. Okay. Now, Tony, you also answered this question.
I did.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan J. M. Rowe did not see Tony's answers, nor did Tony see Jonathan J. M. Rowe's answers. Both of them saw their own answers. Tony, where does this rank?
I said this was, I made a distinction between my favorite albums and their best, which is, of course, I have to be wordy.
We
right?
do that at the end of every show.
But I'd say that in terms of best all-around LPs, it's third in general, like overall to me, third, maybe fourth. It's probably my favorite Beatles album, though.
Okay. That's right. You're correct. That's what you did say. All right. Then the next question, does John or Paul win this album? And I've got to tell you, when I'm listening to this, I feel like I've got box scores from baseball. And I go, okay, that's a 5. That inning was 5 for John. Mm-hmm. Oh, Paul, that was a little weak. You got a 3 on that inning. Yeah. I feel like I'm doing that listening to this album.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
And you get the seventh inning stretch with John jumping. I mean, George jumping in every now and then. Mm-hmm. Okay, does John or Paul come across more strongly on this album?
I said John.
Well, I know, but I haven't told anyone in our podcast universe yet. So you said John.
Yes.
Tony?
I also said quantity-wise, John. He's got the stronger songs, but I think I've just seen A Face as a remarkable song, and it's hard to argue. I think I even said this. It's hard to argue with 2,200-plus covers of Yesterday.
The most covered song
ever.
Ever.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I can't even... I know I have a list of people who, but I never hear anyone else's.
I've got some clips of some of the interesting ones.
There's some terrible ones, yes.
I tell you what,
Molly Hatchet covered that song.
Did it get a southern sound?
I never listened to it. I couldn't bring myself to do it.
I just don't understand hearing that and thinking I needed to mess with it. That's it's like Over the Rainbow. Mm-hmm. Everybody that touched that song, it destroyed them, except for that fat Hawaiian.
Yeah, he did something magical with it. You're right.
And if you're a fat Hawaiian, I apologize.
Who sings?
That sings with the ukulele. And that's not to say the ukulele needs two more strings. What is the best song on this album? Bum, bum, bum! Jonathan J. M. Rowe?
Ticket to Ride.
You agree with what you said earlier?
Yes.
And T?
I said Ticket to Ride as well, although I've just seen A Face as a tough, real close second.
I'm going to agree with you. It's a great second.
Yeah, but did you see how concise you were?
Yeah. I apologize to everyone in podcast land. I'm a
there's
talker.
There's no concision. Is that a word? Concision. Beware of the concision. Number four, JM. Mm-hmm. What is the worst song on this album?
Dizzy, Miss Lizzy.
And T?
I'm going to be concise. I agree. Not, well, you know what? No, I'm not going to be concise. I think You Like Me Too Much is the worst song on the album. Dizzy, Miss Lizzy is a great song. It just doesn't fit on this album. So it should not be on it.
It would be fun in concert.
It's a great version. It just doesn't fit on this album at all.
Yeah. Okay, I always thought Dizzy, Miss Lizzy was the result of his voice being so great with those type of tunes like Postman and
Twist my God. And Shout. Wait a minute, Mr. Postman is...
His voice, he knows, and I think he probably so did it, and he said, yeah, that sounds good. And then everybody in the world told him, man, you got a voice for this. And so...
I'm going to get in. I've got that kind of stuff in my notes.
Maybe he should have not jumped in there so quickly. All right, now, here's another question I have about this album, and then we'll proceed forward with a little of the history of how we got to this album. And I don't mean... we're not going to tell you that they... met in Liverpool and all that. That is something to be said about the Beatles. I probably know more about the Beatles than any other band that we've talked about, even bands I like better. And I know Tony knows a whole bunch. I know Jonathan knows a bunch, but it's all discounted by the fact that everyone who listens to this podcast probably knows a bunch.
Right.
So we've made a conscious decision that we're not going to go into how they went to Hamburg and all. We're not going to go do all of that. We're not going to talk about Pete Best. We're going to talk about this album.
We're going to make assumptions that people know about the band, and we're just
That sounds so trite because we think.
If we didn't, we would sound so ridiculous, and so many the people that love the Beatles would turn us off because nobody needs to be told that.
So I've been listening to this album a lot, even though I know it, just because we're doing this.
You had an excuse to.
Well, and also I think we all agree we listen to it differently when we're thinking about what we're doing.
That's for sure.
But what I was listening to it this morning when I was dropping my daughter off at school, and I said to her, and I think this is true, before I ever owned a Beatles album, and I know my mom owned some, but they were all scratched to hell, so we never listened to them. I bet I knew 60 to 70% of the lyrics to every Beatles song.
That's true.
Before I even owned one of their albums.
And I was thinking about the same thing today when I was listening to it, and I was thinking, one of the stupidest things in the whole world is a Beatles greatest hits album.
Yep.
That is just so unnecessary and so pointless. It's not like you have to wade through a bunch of garbage on any Beatles album.
Yeah, there's not a lot of just outtakes or B-sides that just... Even though there are B-sides.
Even the songs they don't like, there's something compelling about those songs.
Yeah, and I think the Beatles are some of the hardest critics the Beatles have ever faced.
Well,
yeah.
John in
John
general.
John just loves to trash
it. He was just a jerk.
Yeah. He's my favorite. Not really. I don't... you're supposed to have a favorite, and I don't think I have one.
I think one of the things,
just like we encourage y'all not to have a favorite, and this is Vinyl Tap.
My favorite is Jam.
Oh, really?
Thanks. Oh, yeah.
Jam got trashed finally, ladies and gentlemen. We've been waiting. I got tacky mail about me. Tony got hate mail. Somebody finally attacked JM. So
because I mispronounced. Ethereal. A word that ethereal. I guess that's how you pronounce it in West Texas.
Ethereal. Well, it doesn't matter. ethereal. We're just thrilled to have JM attacked, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, now I have humilities. So
he's got more to be humble about.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've made it about JM again. All right. This is album number
five.
Five?
Their fifth studio album.
It's so hard with Beatles albums because you have the UK release, you have the US release, yeah. and songs are jumping from album to album.
Well, the you got.
We're about to hear that UK so much better than the US again.
When it comes to the Beatles, it is.
When it comes to Beatles release.
Yes.
Most of the Beatles were from the UK.
Most of them, I think, were, yeah.
Which does not stand for the University of Kentucky.
60% of them, I think, were British. No, but I mean, I think it matters just to talk about it because, yeah, it's weird that what Capitol did was they wanted to make money. They were milking their cash cow, essentially. Yeah, so they were cool songs.
Exactly the same thing I would have done.
Yeah.
We're a little bit outside of our lane with some of these records because this is where singles are coming out independent of albums.
Right. Yeah.
So this is a little bit before the album experience. Which Beatles album was the first one that...
Rubber Soul.
It came out without any?
Oh.
Not in the U.S.
Without... Oh, no. JM said it. It was... Sergeant Pepper's was
That's the first one where no singles had come out prior to it.
Oh, release. I don't know about that. But it was the first one they didn't pull tracks off of and save in the on the U.S. version.
Yeah. Mm. The singles that came out were Penny Lane and
Strawberry Fields. It was a double A-side.
Yeah, that was a double A-side.
But that wasn't...
That wasn't on the
Sergeant
album.
Sergeant Pepper's was album. It was recorded as a unit.
I think so.
Why weren't those two on that album? I can tell you a couple that you could get off of there. Ladies and gentlemen, I think Sergeant Pepper's is a fine album, but I think it also is one of the most overrated things that's ever happened.
I agree with you.
That's going to be another podcast because I'm going to disagree with that. But
oh wow, that's so funny! The guy who thinks the Beatles killed rock and roll is disagreeing with me and you about Sgt. Pepper's.
All right, so now that we've mentioned
mentioned your horrible concept.
I just got kicked off of leadership.
Sorry, that's because JM has to tell us how the Beatles killed rock and roll.
Oh yeah, Tony.
Well, I'm not the only one who has said that, right? I mean, I can't be the only person that has said
that. Well, there's also people that think the Earth is flat and that the moon landing was fake, too. So you're right.
I saw a video of a lamp falling on the moon landing, so I know it's fake. Plus, they had cue cards. It was obvious they were reading cue cards.
They were reading his one small step for messed up.
That wasn't yours. That's the guy coming down the ladder that's supposed to read that.
Yeah.
All right, JM.
All right.
We're getting silly here tonight.
Yep.
And we're a very serious podcast. How did the Beatles destroy rock and roll or ruin rock and roll or whatever you say?
All right. So this, I'm going to say this with in all sincerity that the Beatles have produced, if you, in the top five albums ever made, the Beatles have two of them.
What are they?
Sgt. Pepper.
And Abbey Road.
Yeah.
Your pet's all right.
Okay, so the Beatles...
Let it bleed. Sorry.
The Beatles were relentless in their pursuit of new sounds, and they came by it honestly. They were influenced by music outside of rhythm and blues. Before them, rock and roll was firmly rooted in rhythm and blues. The Beatles did not come from that.
I don't know enough about this person I'm about to say, and I hate to admit that on a podcast from Texas, but was Buddy Holly steeped in rhythm and blues? I don't think so.
I think that that's one of the things that came to my head was, yeah, Buddy Holly.
Roy Orbison, was he steeped in the blues? I mean, those are two rock and roll... Foundational rock and roll guys.
But the foundation that both of them had was that they still wanted your body to get up and move.
Well, they got Little Richard. You can't say that they stepped over Little Richard. They were
who the Beatles?
Yeah,
no, they didn't.
They
right.
So
right.
that's a rhythm blues, and they were impacted.
Chuck Berry as well.
But the point is that some of the stuff that was coming out was so steeped in. You know, everybody would call black music. I mean, the rhythm and blues came from blues, and it started becoming rhythmic, and it became rock and roll, and became music to very much to dance to. Really, like if you listen to "That'll Be the Day," that definitely does not come from some sort of country folk tradition. That comes very much from rhythm and blues. Get your body moving, and to get it on American Bandstand or some place where it would be, people would be dancing to it. I mean, that was the whole point, was to make your body move, was much of what was happening with rock and roll at that time. And you can make, there are exceptions, but I think that even the Beatles were playing stuff that was originally was designed to, they weren't singing Blue Bayou and stuff like that originally. They were trying to make music that would make people dance. And
you know, they wanted to let all the children boogie.
I guess so. But most of it came from, you know, almost all of it came from the black tradition. And, you know, white guys tried to do it with, like I was saying, with very varying levels of success. You know, but there was still like Chuck Berry, there was Little Richard, there was Fats Domino, and there were lesser known folks like Big Mama Thornton, Arthur Alexander. The music that just came from them was natural. It just came, they were steeped in that. That's how they, there was like lesser known white guys that could kind of do it, like Elvis and Buddy Holly.
Lesser known why? Who was Elvis again? Just the king of rock and roll.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But there was white guys that could do it. Elvis, yeah. Buddy
Presley,
Holly.
Presley, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Not Costello.
Gene Vincent, all those guys. But they were still tethered to what made rock and roll rock and roll. Where it came from, the rhythm and blues.
And the Beatles broke that tether.
I think the Beatles were the ones that kind of that broke that tether.
I think there's an argument for that.
And their influence became, was so organic, because they grew up in much different musical traditions. Paul McCartney was into the American Songbook. Ringo Starr was into country music.
Skiffle?
Skiffle was kind of, I guess, kind of a, I'm not entirely sure where.
That was all over.
All over.
And they all, at one point, were in a skiffle band, weren't they?
Yeah. That was the thing, skiffle.
So the thing I want to say, the Beatles were so, they absorbed so much. They were so open to that kind of stuff. That was just how they grew up, with so much different music. They really weren't trying to emulate anybody else. They did it first. What, four or five songs written by the Beatles, but the rest were covers. And their second album was a little bit, few covers, but.
Yeah, this album tonight is the last album with any covers on it until the Let It Be sessions.
Yeah, they could incorporate stuff that they heard, and it just became natural for them to write these songs. But they'd hear a cantata, they would hear a symphony, and they would say, "Hey, there's a, you know, a Bach trumpet in there. We'd like to incorporate that into our sound." It was just so natural for them, and they were such good players, and they were such studio hacks that they could figure out ways to make things sound different, and they were open to so many different ideas. The point is, it was organic for them to become the Beatles. Everything that came after them, it wasn't organic. They were copying the Beatles. They weren't actually, they didn't have the experience. They didn't have the, they just knew that we wanted to sound like the Beatles, but they didn't. And so instead of coming like what they were used to playing, they kept trying to do something totally different. The Rolling Stones tried doing it. You know, the Monkees did it to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a direct line from this album/film to the Monkees.
Yeah.
So this came before the Monkees?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. It did.
Yeah.
All right.
So I guess...
trying to lighten it up here a little bit, ladies and gentlemen.
So what I'm trying to say is that there are so many bands that I like that were influenced by the Beatles, because the thing that it did do is it started saying like, hey, we don't have to make records the same way we always have made them. And it got studio executives to say, hey, we don't have to find music that is just going to make people dance. You know, the purpose of this podcast, albums started becoming the bigger, you know,
seems like you're saying that they're the most influential band of all time.
I would say that they're the most influential band of all time, but I think that many
one of the
bands,
ways they influenced is they opened up they brought tributaries of all kinds of music into the mainstream flow,
right?
Like nobody else could have done,
right? But and for them, it
expanded it so much beyond just rhythm and blues music.
But it became, or it was organic for them, and there's so many bands that came after them, and there's notable exceptions. The Beach Boys, I think, are a notable exception.
Well, they're not an after the Beatles band.
I'm going to take just a minor exception to something you said in terms of being organic. I think the reason, if you're going to say any of that expansion stuff was organic, was because of the fifth Beatle, George Martin.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with
George Martin. Was a classical, right? A classical and maybe jazz, I can't remember, but definitely a classical producer. And he was able to, and he's much older than them. Well, I don't, not much older, but definitely older than them. And he was able to bring stuff to the table and encourage them in a way that, and they listened to him in a way that opened up that. And you're right. I mean, McCartney, you know, he came from this sort of his I think his dad and mom were
folk English,
well,
folk tunes.
Also that kind of dance hall tradition, mm-hmm. that British dance hall tradition as well. But
there's a video of him explaining how the Beatles started writing more complicated songs. He was sitting there at a piano and he goes, and then he hit like this, a diminished chord, and he goes, well, that comes from the folk tradition. That doesn't come from the rock and roll tradition. And he said, well, that's where we started figuring out that maybe we had, there was something, our influences were a little different.
I don't think anybody's going to argue with what you're saying about that.
Right, but what I'm going to say is that...
How did that kill rock and roll?
Because so many people wanted to emulate the Beatles rather than get to... what the rock and they wanted to experiment, but my point is they could not do it as well as the Beatles did.
But I still don't know how that kills rock and roll.
Because music started becoming
disco?
Well, it became something.
You mean it splattered all over the place after the Beatles?
Yeah, it splattered all over the place after the Beatles, and so many people tried to be the Beatles that it was almost laughable how many people tried to become the Beatles.
Well, I don't think you can hear the Beatles and walk away unscathed. That may be what you mean, because everybody
hears right. this but music. But then you hear
they can't stuff go. That, you can't go back. You can't put it back in the box.
I guess why I've always just had a little bit of a, probably more than a little bit of a bone of contention with when you've said that in the past, is that if that's true, rock and roll was around for 10 years and then died.
Well, I don't think I'm the only person that would say that that's true.
So I guess that means everything after
until the Ramones came.
Everything until after 1965 was post rock.
I actually thought of that today while I was running.
I'm really not trying to be facetious. I just
I think that's a very interesting thing that Jonathan J.M. Rowe brought up. And I would encourage all our listeners to write Jonathan J.M. Rowe and comment on that. Tony, do you have anything else to say about this album?
I actually, when we get back to talking about the album, this album, what's interesting about it is all the firsts that were surrounding it.
There's let's go through first.
Okay. Well, I think real quick, even though we're not talking about the movie, we should talk about the influence that had on this album, because the distinction between the US and the UK versions of this album was the UK version had 14 songs that were all Beatles songs. The US version had 7 tracks on it that were actually in the movie, and then the rest of it was all instrumental orchestral stuff that they added soundtrack stuff.
And some of it was like from, what was the movie before that? Hard Day's Night. Some of it was instrumental version
right.
of Hard Day's Night.
But the thing that's really kind of interesting about this, and I guess it sort of goes to what you were talking about, Jam, to a certain extent, although I don't think it has the same emphasis on them having a negative impact on rock and roll. But I will say that in 65, when this happened, or actually 64 prior to this, you've got Lennon. Well, you got all the guys hearing Dylan for the first time, but Lennon really takes that to heart.
Yeah,
it starts influencing his.
You can't read about this album without hearing.
It starts influencing
that influence
Lennon, and then on McCartney's side, he's dating. Oh my lord,
Jane Asher.
Jane Asher, thank you. He's dating Jane Asher, and because of that, her family is. He's getting all sorts of other influences as you speak, like symphonic influences, jazz influences, all these things. He's getting exposed to that. So his writing style starts going a different way. So Help is the inklings. It's the beginnings of all this stuff kind of seeping in. It's the first album since their debut that Harrison actually has songs that he wrote. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, he was singing Lennon McCartney songs, but he wrote two songs for this album. We'll talk about them as we get to them, but that's kind of a big deal. I think one of the things I find interesting about
Who did you say that Paul McCartney was dating?
Jane Asher. Of Peter and...
Peter
Asher's sister.
Yeah.
Who was George Harrison dating?
Patty.
We've all been here. We're not going to go there, ladies and gentlemen, but I just want to make Tony upset.
Oh, because, yeah. Cause,
Patty Boyd.
Patty Boyd ended up leaving George Harrison for an inferior songwriter, but a better guitarist.
The Patty Boyd song, Clapton, excuse me, the Patty Boyd songs Clapton wrote beat the Patty Boyd song on this album.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but
especially the outro.
So do you know what this song, I have some questions for you guys. There's some trivia.
All right.
Sure. What was Help, the movie, going to be called before it was called Help?
Ouch. Oh, I read that today.
Hmm? Ouch.
No, but that is a reference
today
to the Ruddles. Yeah. Eight Arms to Hold You. Do you know why it was going to be called Eight Arms to Hold You?
Because the Beatles were going to be holding you.
Wrong.
The Rolling Stones were.
No, it's because if you've seen the film, it's got there's a Indian cult in it.
Oh, and they go into that temple.
And there's a Kylie, I guess, or Kylie, I don't know how you say it, but multi-armed statue that they worship is got eight arms.
It's so, an avatar. So you're being highly offensive.
That was Ringo's idea to call it that.
I remember that. It's also George Harrison's first experience to that culture and to the sitar.
Yeah.
Well, which I think is going to play a prominent role later.
No, it is. And I think that's important to mention that this, the filming of that film
restaurant scene,
had got all of them into that. But there's a scene in I think it's a restaurant where a sitar is playing. Is it A Hard Day's Night or something? It's a Beatles song on sitar, and Harrison's like,
that sounds pretty good. Yeah, that's right. They were playing. They did an arrangement of A Hard Day's Night on sitar.
He got into it.
Yeah.
But
too bad he got beat by the Kinks.
What I was going to say is so Richard Lester, who directed the film and also directed A Hard Day's Night, said he always wanted the album to be called, or the movie to be called Help. But there was another movie that was contractually called Help, but they found a loophole.
Exclamation point.
An exclamation point. By adding the exclamation point, they could move ahead and call the movie Help. They had written 8 days a week, supposedly, for the Eight Arms to Hold You, but now they had to write a song, Help. So,
and he kicked butt.
Yeah.
And so, we've said this before, and I'm disappointed in you, Tony, but I'm being disappointed in you without giving you a chance to be disappointed. But that is... It is one of the greatest openings of any
album. Oh, absolutely. And I have that
planet.
When we get to this
pre-rock and roll, post-rock and roll, I don't care.
No, I agree. When we get to the songs, that's the very first thing in my note is this is maybe the single best way to open an album ever.
And and John Lennon's so wrong that he's upset that it was high energy.
Yeah, no, he is.
Yeah.
But here's some facts. Here's some facts about this album that I find interesting.
Just the facts.
Yeah. It's I already mentioned is the last album to feature any cover songs until they did Let It Be. It has the very first Harrison composition since Don't Bother Me, which were on with the Beatles. It's the first time a Fender Strat was ever on a Beatles album.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Which song was it on? We'll talk about that.
Oh,
as
Oh, don't get to know. Yeah.
Well, I've got. It's the first time McCartney played lead guitar on a Beatles album.
Didn't know that either.
It's the first time they used strings on a Beatles song. Yesterday,
I did know that. Yeah.
It's the first time that a Beatles song only had one member performing on it. Also yesterday, first time that ever happened. Hmm. It's the very first rock and roll album ever nominated for Album of the Year for a Grammy. It lost to September of My Years, the Frank Sinatra album. I don't know if it was a U.S. album or the U.K. album. I'm assuming it's a U.S. album, but
gotta be, yeah.
It was also, just to go over, well, we'll talk about that later. I was going to talk about it. It's got a bunch of Grammy nominations.
Was it the first album to have the word Nujv on it?
Oh, you want to talk about the cover? Well, let's do that since you brought it up. So you want to go ahead and start talking about that?
Yeah, Boy Scouts made a semaphore, a merit badge, and on the cover of the album Help. It would make a lot of sense to have the word help.
Well, they wanted to do that. It just didn't look good.
It didn't look good. No. So the once again, content loses to fashion. So we get Nujv.
Well, so there's two different versions of the picture. There's the UK version, which spells out N-U-J-V. And then the US version spells out N-V-U-J. And it's got McCartney pointing at the Capitol logo. That's why they picked that one.
I don't understand. That's so stupid to me. Yeah. Why even go to the trouble of doing that, which is a great idea. It's a fantastic idea.
It is.
And then you screw it up because it doesn't look right.
Well, because most people don't know it. Most people who look at that assume. I always, until I knew this, because I don't know the semaphore alphabet, I always assumed it spelled help.
Yeah, and it really made me mad when I learned that. Of course, as soon as I saw it, I knew it wasn't correct. Anyway, back to the trivia.
Need somebody.
Well, here, I just want to real quick go through all the, because it's interesting, the Grammy Awards. So it was nominated for Song of the Year for Yesterday, and it lost to Shadow of Your Smile. Don't know who that is, but best vocal
matter. Nobody remembers.
Best vocal performance, Paul McCartney on Yesterday, lost to Frank Sinatra. It Was a Very Good Year. Best performance by a vocal group, lost to the Anita Kerr Quartet for We Dig Mancini. Best contemporary rock and roll. Best contemporary single for Yesterday, lost to King of the Road by Roger Miller.
Oh, I'm not going to say anything.
Best contemporary vocal performance by a male, Paul McCartney, also lost to Roger Miller, King of the Road. Best contemporary performance by a group, vocal or instrumental, The Beatles' Help, lost to Flowers on the Wall by the Statler Brothers.
That's a great song.
Help lost to... It's a great song, but Help shouldn't lose to Flowers on the Wall.
I'll agree with you.
Best arrangement accompanying a vocalist or instrumentalist, George Martin for Yesterday, and Gordon Jenkins won for It's a Very Good Year. And then a best original motion picture score or TV show for the movie, lost to... Sandpiper. I don't know what that is, but anyway, just kind of interesting looking at that snapshot in time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you are one of these people that waste your Sunday night watching award shows, it's a very good lesson to see how the garbage floats to the top on many of those. Okay, a lot of people are probably wondering what song kicks off this album.
Yeah, should I play that song, Doug?
The answer to that question with the Beatles is always...
Maybe we could help them. Yes.
Now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind, I'll open up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down. And I do appreciate you being right.
I've got a couple of questions for you guys.
Sure.
All right.
Number one, I am unable to answer this question. Are there any other songs where the background singers take the lead ahead of the lead singer?
Well, do they do that, or they just kind of stretch out the same lines?
They anticipate what he's going to say.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's maybe some other Beatles songs that do that, because I think that seems like a Beatle trademark.
I have never noticed it until this deep dive, but I found that and it is really interesting.
Well, and what's cool about it is it resolves itself at the end of the line where they sing together. Yeah, I think it's amazing. That's one of my favorite things about that song.
I think it is super, super cool.
Yeah.
And I want to know more about it. I want to know why it's not commented upon.
Yeah.
I can't think of anybody else doing that.
I think there's some like Sam and Dave numbers and stuff where they might do that. But Not to this degree.
I mean, there's a, like, this guy goes and then I go. That's a Sam and Dave deal. That's normal. But we got clearly designated background singers.
But they're not singing the whole line.
No.
Which is cool.
They say, and now.
And then Lennon kicks in. But I, just the way it resolves at the end is
if you're in a rock and roll band and you're not copying this, you're stupid.
You know, Lennon said this and Strawberry Fields is two favorite Beatles songs. Which surprised me that this was. It's such a great song.
He said that they were his, that they were the most honest.
Yeah.
That the less, the way I took his comment was, these are the least constructed or fabricated. They were the most organic. They were the most from the heart, maybe.
Yeah.
That's the way to say it. If you don't like this song.
Well, just that there's so many things.
If you don't like this song,
You're a bad person.
You're a bad person.
You're a horrible person.
Well, and just the arpeggios that come in behind it are just remarkable. And it's got even got the harmony arpeggios that go in behind it. It's
And the harmony, that's McCartney and Harrison singing together. It's wonderful. They sound great.
So
the harmony is going to be a all-star player on this album.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. So when we talked about Matthew Sweet, I said there's not anybody that uses harmony as well as he does, with one exception. These guys, it's not just...
I mean, going to add the Beach Boys.
Well, okay, yeah. but we're not... I got you.
Yeah.
But the Beach Boys, the Beach Boys is something other. I'm talking about the way Beatles do it.
It's almost like the way that Gregorian chants
use it. Yeah, it's on a different level.
But the Beatles do it in kind of a similar way to Matthew Sweet. They use it to punctuate things. And it adds depth to the song. It's coloration. It's just the way they do it is just... It's remarkable, you know?
Well, and this song, at the very beginning, we realize, if we haven't listened to the Beatles before, you have two of the best singers in rock and roll in the same band, and they sound fantastic together.
They absolutely, absolutely.
And I don't know how you get all these happy accidents. Two gifted songwriters and... Two great singers who sound great together.
And a third one who is not a...
And a third one who's going to surprise us. I've said all the time that the Beatles started with two great singers and they ended with two great singers, but not the same two.
It's nice of you to say that about Ringo. No, that's funny. I want to go back to something you briefly mentioned, Doug, and that was Lennon's original take on the song.
He wanted it to be a ballad.
Yeah.
Well, he wanted it to. I think this was him in a confessional mood.
It was.
From all I can read.
Yeah.
And he wanted his confession to be more of a slow.
Well, that's another thing. One of the things I was trying to say earlier was that songs started becoming. I mean, you said they listened to Dylan, but their songs started becoming more confessional. Mm-hmm.
Well,
they're listening to Dylan instead of...
And they're also doing something Motown. That makes them somewhat introspective. Doing a lot of something that makes them somewhat introspective. Yeah. They're smoking the wacky tobacco.
Well, yeah, and I think that...
And those two are connected. The Dylan...
They are.
Dylan's connected to both of those.
Yeah.
Shame on you, Bobby.
But I think... And I don't think that... This is where Lennon starts taking off. For me, in the early part, like I always thought that he was in the early days. I always thought Lennon was the stronger.
Well, he was, songwriter. And I think McCartney would agree with that. I think McCartney was always playing catch up, and then somewhere along,
even though McCartney's hits came first, I think "Love Me Do" was McCartney's song, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah,
no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, I think it was weird because McCartney's songs were always. Like the big hits, but Lennon's songs were stronger and there were more of them.
Well,
he was a writing machine.
Yeah, he was.
And the Beatles said he was their Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant something. As little known as Elvis was at the time. that was like the top bar. And I know why they said that. He's got the presence. He has the voice. Mm-hmm. He's got the powerful, powerful voice.
Well,
I want to say something about his. I think this album is Lennon's best singing album.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that.
He is so strong on Ticket to Ride, Help strong. It's just
even the songs he doesn't like, his vocals are great on.
He's got a big fat sound, mm-hmm. and that doesn't last. Something I don't know what happens to diminish his voice as the albums go on, but
Yoko.
I don't think it's that so much. I think it's Yoko. Just because
I think his ability.
I don't think I don't he cared anymore. I think he stopped caring.
Well, I think he was taking a lot of medicine that makes you not care.
Well,
and yeah, I also think that he must have been doing something that hurt his power in his voice, because when you see him singing Twist and Shout at
Prince Albert Hall,
yeah, he's not even trying and he's belting it out.
Yeah.
And by the time we get to Abbey Road.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. His voice.
He's got to turn up the reverb so much.
Well, he starts double tracking and stuff mm-hmm. too. Yeah.
He does that on this though. They all do that. They all double track their voices.
They don't sound as robust.
No, I agree. Yeah. So this what's fascinating about his take on Help and how it was too, like, he didn't like the fact that they sped it up, and the reason they did it was because they saw the commercial potential of speeding it up. He says the exact same thing about Please Please Me. That was supposed to be a slower song that they sped up for a commercial. Can you imagine that song slowed down? God, Please no. Please Me. It's a weird thing for him to say that, but he felt the same way. So
I don't see how a slow song could have gotten the desperation that's so much at the heart of this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he does that with other slow songs.
I'm having trouble thinking.
Mother, I'm a Loser.
That doesn't have the hanging on to the the life's. I'm grabbing on to.
How about All I Want to Do? Listen to his vocals on that song. That's one of my favorite vocal performances of his ever. And that
to me, this sounds like he's hollering and he's trying to reach for the line to get back on.
Go back and listen to All I Got to Do, because that's vocal performance is incredible.
If we go ahead and finish the podcast before I do that.
Sorry. So a little interesting fact about this song is that Maureen Cleave, who was the woman who wrote the article about the Beatles, say they're big, the interview where Lennon said he's bigger than Jesus.
Yeah.
She was friends with him, and she gave him a hard time and said, you need to write songs with more than one syllable in it. You need to expand your vocabulary a little bit. So this was an attempt. He started using three syllable words in the song, and he said she still wasn't impressed when he played it for her. So whatever.
Yeah.
But this, so this song was topped the charts on both sides of the Atlantic, in the US and the UK, and it sold better than the other two songs that came before it, which were released, I Feel Fine and Ticket to Ride. This song did better than both of those songs.
It's a great song.
It's a fantastic song. Ranked number 29 on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time in 2004. Here's where Rolling Stone screwed up. When they revisited the list in 2021, they moved it up to 447.
That's the PC list, I'm convinced.
They go from 29 to 447. How do you do that?
That's because they're trying to say, we had minorities and women or something.
There's always, in this early Beatles stuff, there's always that conversation, I guess later on too, about who did what. You know, and McCartney says that this was 70% Lennon, maybe even more than that. Really, all he did was he wrote the counter melody to John on the song. So,
yeah.
It's all such a great
tune. And it didn't impress that woman.
No.
Okay. Our box score is, we all give 5 for that one, right?
Yeah. It's one of their best songs ever.
That's a great, I mean, it's 5 and it's pressing up as high as 5 can go. Up next is The Night Before.
We said our goodbye the night before. Love was in your eyes the night before. Now today I find you have changed your mind. Treat me like you did the night before.
Okay, so I just talked about how strong John's voice sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, this is the album where John is super strong. And then Paul comes on and he sounds really strong on this song.
He does, but by comparison, it is such a letdown to Help to me. Lyric-wise, It's got a really, really cool guitar solo in it. That's the one thing I'll say about it.
It's not as good a song as Help, but no. His voice is
strong. His voice sounds great.
The guitar solo is a dual solo.
Yeah.
It's Harrison and McCartney both playing.
Well, it starts off, I can't figure out who starts first, but then there's a 12-string comes in behind it.
That's likely Harrison playing
the
12-string.
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing, yeah.
There's a lot of 12-string.
This is the first song, a Beatles song, to have an electric piano on it.
Yeah.
And it sounds great. It's a Hohner piano or a Pianet electric. I don't even know how you pronounce
it. Piano Nice.
I wrote it down in my notes because it's all over this. And it comes out pretty, it's pretty conspicuous in some later songs.
Yeah. Well, especially when Lennon overdubs it on a couple of songs and it sounds, but it always adds a good depth to the song.
I like the way it sounds.
I do too.
Yeah.
I like this song a lot. I don't think it needs to apologize to anybody.
I don't think so either. And it's got what I was talking about before, that quintessential Beatles ooh-ah thing where they'll do that thing where it's and then they move up they move up and down. Yeah. There's not another band that does that as good as they do.
No, you're right. It's one of the things that makes you, we talked about it with the Moody Blues where they have a background sound that is so immediately recognizable.
Yeah.
You're like that. You know who it is.
Oh, and the drums. It's quintessential.
So,
Ringo on that. You know,
I want to say publicly, I want to apologize to Ringo Starr because I have dismissed him throughout my history of listening to music, and he is a fine drummer and maybe the perfect drummer for this band.
He's the perfect drummer for this band. If I could have any drummer in a band, it would. If I were to front a band, I would have Ringo as my drummer.
I watched this guy that was. He was telling a story about interviewing a drummer for his band, and the guy said something about Ringo being way overrated, and he tells him, "Well, play Act Naturally for me."
And you know how he plays it,
and it's that shuffle it wears the guy out, and he can't finish it.
And there is, I think, a quintessential Beatle beat. Like you hear a beat and it's like that's a Beatle beat.
Well, and by the time you get to Abbey Road, he's doing such cool things.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's a good drummer.
He's amazing.
I agree.
There's a bass player in this band also.
Oh my God. There's another.
Ladies and gentlemen, usually I make fun of bass players, but I really like Paul's melodic bass playing. This song is a great exception to that. He is just boom, 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 boom. I mean, he's so disciplined on this.
Well, you know, his original influence was James Jamerson from the...
I thought it was a movie actress.
No, the bass player for Sex Machine.
James Brown.
Yeah.
Of all the songs he has, you could only think of one with the name Sex in it. I'm highly offended. Well, one of the things that caught my attention with this song is how the bass is so under control compared to most of McCartney stuff.
We disparage basses a lot as a joke around here, but I've always been a fan of bass players, ones that are melodic like that. I love melodic bass players
too.
that play, there's not just a rhythm. They're doing something really interesting.
I ought to say that I like bass players a lot. I only make fun of them because James.
I know. I know that. So Lennon was one of the guys that disparaged the song, and it's this quote where he says, "I'll just say it's Paul's," meaning I don't remember anything about it except it was in the movie, which is really a horrible thing to say. Because as you said, I don't think this song needs to apologize for anything.
No, I don't think so either.
Well, it's we're on this level now where. Any other band that we talked about, if they wrote this song, it would be going, look at me, look what I did.
Yeah.
Goal. All right. So I think with our box scores, I still have
Lennon's
ahead. Yeah. But Paul hasn't embarrassed himself.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Up next week, we've got the change. You've got to hide your love away.
Each and every day. I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say, "Hey, you've got to hide your love away."
top that song.
Mm-mm. I know, it's such a good song.
Who did y'all say he just met?
Dylan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Dylan. Yeah, this is the song that this is a song everyone points to as being the most influenced by Dylan at this point in his career.
This I love this song.
It's a great song.
And his voice is again.
It's incredible.
It's very attractive.
It's not double tracked. It's
only him singing on it though, too. There's no harmony vocals on this song whatsoever.
There's one thing about this song I don't like. That's the ending.
Really?
With the horns or the flutes that are coming in. I think
they could have. I like when they do the solo.
A commercial ending.
I love those. I think the reason why is because I can hear that influencing so many other bands I like. I guess
it disappoints me so much because this is a raw guy sitting on a staircase talking about his heart, and then here comes.
You know, it was the first session musician they ever had in the studio. That guy playing. Yeah, he plays the John Scott. He plays the tenor and the alto flute.
I wish you would have waited an album or two.
Here is the funny thing. Little, what do you want to call it? This funny twist or whatever. So, as Lennon starts being influenced by Dylan and picking up an acoustic guitar and playing on that is around the same time Dylan decides to put the acoustic down and start picking up the electric guitar.
It was like a week before I was reading about Dylan getting influenced by the Beatles. So it's that badminton game we've been talking about between the U.S. and England. It goes back and forth over and over again.
So here's another interesting thing. So I'm going to read you the first line of "I don't believe you." She acts like we've never met off of another side of Bob Dylan. All right. "Here I stand, heads in hand." Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm sorry. I was reading it.
That's about
cut. So I'm about to read you the lyrics to "I don't believe you." She acts like we've never met off of another side of Bob Dylan. "I can't understand. She let go of my hand and left me here facing the wall. I'd like to know why she did go, but I can't get close to her at all." And then the first line of this song is, "Here I stand, head in hand, turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on, feeling 2 foot small."
Whoa.
Yeah. So it's interesting.
It is.
The 2 foot small thing was a mistake. Did you know that?
I always thought it was a mistake. I thought it was a bad line.
He meant to say 2 foot tall, and when he said 2 foot small, McCartney's like, "That's good, keep that in there."
So well, I don't like either one, so I guess I'm okay.
And then the "hey," right before the that was a guy named Pete Shotton, who was in the Quarrymen with Lennon, was in the studio at the time, and he said, "You should yell hey," you know.
Well, he was right. That worked.
Now I want to play you a cover of this song.
"Here I stand, head in hand, turn my face to the wall.
Wow, we're experts.
I can't go on with no love at all."
It's a connection as well, guys. Yeah, sort of.
Waylon.
It's Waylon.
Who else could that be?
Love of the Common People had that song on it. That was one of his pre-outlaw album.
I tell you what, if there's a lot of jobs I would like to have gotten, but I would have loved to have been in charge of telling Willie and Waylon what songs not to cover. This one and MacArthur Park.
Yeah,
you heard Waylon do MacArthur Park. Yeah. God, I mean, does he not have friends?
Speaking about Lennon's voice on this song, Waylon's is the exact opposite. In terms of fitting the tune.
Oh, no, it does not fit it at all.
It is so wrong. It sounds like he's beating people up. He's like pounding on these people as he's walking through the mushroom land, beating up hippies. It doesn't work. But fortunately, there's a track number 4. And ladies and gentlemen, it's from my score right now, we've got John at 10 and Paul probably at about 4.
Yeah.
And here we go for a little relief. "I need you.
I need you. Love you all the time. I'll never leave you. Please come on back to me. I'm lonely as can be. I need you."
All right. And that's a break because that's George Harrison.
That's not a bad song.
I really like that song a lot.
I don't know why people are so dismissive of it. It seems strange to me.
The two songs on this album are the only two songs Harrison wrote that he didn't talk about in his like in-depth.
Really? So,
yeah, he didn't like either one of these songs, and I don't know why.
Well, I know one reason.
Is strong.
His voice is great on it. I think one reason is this is one of the first uses of a volume pedal
and ever it's misused. On a record,
and it is misused.
Well, and supposedly the way it worked is that Lennon was kneeling down on the studio floor doing it while
Harrison
was playing the guitar.
It's off.
It's very. And very obnoxious.
Because it just punctuates the...
Ramp, ramp.
Well, it's not ramp, even done... Ramp. Yeah, and it's before the days of...
Bad sound effects in Star Trek.
They don't even have... there's no reverb on it, and there's... It got use of digital...
I don't know why it's any different than if he'd just taken his hand and gone wah-wah on the volume.
Yeah, I don't know why he wouldn't have done that. But
it's a good song.
His it's a voice great song, but it's just... Get I don't understand why they there. Left that. Yeah, why did George Martin let that come in?
You know how the percussion's being played on it?
I don't think I do.
I don't.
Ringo is hitting the back of a Gibson Jumbo acoustic guitar.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
It does. And then, Ringo's playing the guitar. It's what I read.
That's what he's beating that's the what back they of called, it. They and call then that Lennon is evidently playing the snare on beats 2 and 4.
Okay. While
Ringo's beating on the back of the.
So everybody gets credit for a new instrument, even though they're not doing anything.
But it's a great song. I mean,
who's it about?
Patty.
We've all been here before.
Well, yeah, they got in a fight. Evidently, she was really jealous and.
Yeah, he's getting all these screaming girls.
Yeah.
I wonder how many songs Patty Boyd has had written about her.
There's actually a website, I think, that devoted to her.
If I were her, I would have started that website.
So at the end of the movie, when the credits are going up and this song shows up, because the other Harrison song is not in it, but this one is Harrison. You can hear Harrison talking about... I Need You by George Harrison. He keeps like, you know, because he excitingly saying it as a joke. It's pretty funny.
Well, I don't think that one brings any shame on him at all.
No, it's a good song.
Good song.
I'm surprised the wah-wah paddle survived.
I really like the background vocals on it too. Yeah. They're that. Yeah. I mean, it's a good song. And it's
interesting to have John and Paul singing background.
Right. Yeah. It's also the reason why I think it's a good song is that I can't hear it without singing along with it. Every time that's I hear true. It, I want to sing catchy. Along with it. It's catchy as hell. Catchy
and song. So is the part I hate. I want to go, wah, wah.
don't you have that sound on our...
He didn't even have to do it either. He just got bounce now, don't now. It would have been fine if he had not hit the volume pedal.
All right. We move on to track number 5, Another Girl.
I ain't no fool and I don't take what I don't want for I've got another girl, she's sweeter than all the girls and I met quite a few, nobody in all the world can do what she can do, and so I'm telling you this time you better stop for I've got.
This is like that quintessential upbeat McCartney song.
It
sounds like I can't you can't like buy me love. She's a woman. Exactly. It sounds like those songs.
And, it could have come off of any of those first two Beatles albums.
He's all happy and upbeat, mm-hmm. and he's telling another girl that he's got another girl. So
Well, he evidently it's based sort of on a true story. He evidently had an apartment in London when he was dating Jane Asher, and he would go hang out there for other rendezvous. So he did have another girl or two or five. Jeez. He was the cute one after all, supposedly.
I don't understand how that works.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, why is he cute?
I don't know. He was the cute one.
He always looks like
Harrison
he's surprised.
Was the quiet one. I don't know what...
Chicks
what,
must like
Ringo
surprised.
Was the funny one.
Yeah, and I don't know what...
Chicks like John surprised
John
guys.
John was the wife beater one, I believe. Sorry.
Paul always looks like, what? What? Whoop.
So, you guys know the history of this song?
Not at all.
I know what you just said, and that's about it.
He wrote it in a bathroom at this Tunisian resort.
Tunisia? What the hell are you doing in Tunisia?
He went there on holiday.
Okay.
And supposedly...
Listen how British holiday. He is. He's on holiday. is he in hospital?
He went to university.
He went to university, yeah.
supposedly... well, according to McCarty, it was a resort owned by the British Embassy, but that's not actually true. It was the Sebastian Villa, which Frank Lloyd Wright said was one of the finest houses ever built. So it's kind of a cool little thing. Hmm. But
he would know.
McCartney plays lead.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he plays the lead on it. And it's a pretty nifty little guitar lead on this song.
Yeah, I like that lead
Harrison had recorded something at the end of the song, this little guitar flourish that he was really proud of. It took him a long time. They did it in 10 takes. It took him 10 takes to get it right. And then when McCartney overdubbed his lead, he took it off the song. Kind of a Paul Simon thing. And then the other interesting thing about the song is it's got three-part harmony, and it's one of the few songs where John sings the high end of the harmony as opposed
to... Oh, that's true. Huh. It is true. You know, what the funny thing in my notes here, I have that Harrison's lead jumps out a little too much. So I guess I can remove the blame from Harrison.
Because it's McCartney?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is not that dissimilar to other things. You're talking about their influence and the whole not being steeped in rhythm and blues or to the extent that other ones were. But they definitely early on started bringing country into their...
Yeah.
And this definitely has a country feel to it.
Well, yeah. And you listen to Close Your Eyes. What am I saying? What is that? You listen to that Chet Atkins guitar lead that... George Harrison does on that song.
Yeah.
How about I Cry Instead off of Hard Day's Night? You can't get more country than that song.
Well, George Harrison, I guess that's George Harrison playing those leads. I mean, Paul McCartney's playing lead on this one and it sounds kind of country.
He a lot of people say this is a filler. The song's a filler.
I don't agree.
He always says that's nonsense because every song they did, and I question that as they got further into their career. But he says at this point, at least, any band could veto a song and it wouldn't be on the album. Any member of the band could say, no, we don't want to do this, and they wouldn't put it on the album. So they all had to agree to like it. So the whole filler argument, he said, is
nonsense. That didn't happen with Rocky Raccoon.
Well, that's what I said. Or, well, I'm not going to talk.
Number nine.
There's other songs that.
Revolution 9. Yeah.
Number 9. All right. You're going to lose that girl.
You're going to lose that girl. Yes, yes, you're going to lose that girl.
You're gonna lose,
yes, yes, you're gonna that, girl. Lose that girl.
If you don't take her out tonight, she's gonna change her
she's
mind.
She's gonna change her mind.
And I will take her out tonight, and I will treat her
I'm
kind.
I'm gonna treat her kind.
You're gonna lose that
yes,
girl.
Yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
You're gonna lose,
yes, yes, you're gonna
girl. Oh man, I love this song.
That's a good song.
That's a strong voice.
Yep.
All right. So
that almost has kind of a Motown feel.
It does. It's very Motown.
And even the lyrics kind of have a Motown.
Now, I got a question for y'all about these bongos.
Ringo goes crazy on the bongos, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
I believe I would have
toned those down.
I would have said.
Is this one of those songs, Doug?
Which one?
You've got a list of songs that would be good without the bongos. And
I didn't know that, but you reminded me that I do have that list.
Is this one of those songs?
This song is fine without bongos. I would go ahead and encourage everybody that's thinking about bongos to seek help and make sure that I'm not saying they're never appropriate, but they're frequently not appropriate. And we've got one of those examples right here. This is a good song, and it's a powerful...
I'm not sure what you would put in place of them, though.
Yeah, I think air.
They don't bother me that much. I've never noticed them until we started drilling down, and then
once I heard them,
you
I was
couldn't
like,
unhear them.
Stop.
No, you couldn't unhear them. That is true.
Like if you see a roach at night.
I could hear maybe congas and some guy that could
I was listening to this song again today, and when the bongos came up, I realized there's like the high bit, and then there's this low bit also.
But I also feel like he don't know what he's doing there.
I agree with you there. I don't think he knows what he's doing. That's why I was saying it could have been like somebody from Santana probably should have played the something
on
that.
Did they have a Santana yet?
So this song is, and you, I don't know if either of you can speak to this, me not being a musician of the group. It's supposedly notable because it's got a key change and the bridge shifts from E major to
yeah,
a G major.
I did notice that.
Not something that was usual for the Beatles. So it's kind of another shift in their.
Yeah, but that's a pretty much of a Motown.
Yeah that would be a Motown trick. Totally, you know, Motown trick. It made me forget.
Sam Cooke trick.
You got to hide your love away. That's all the. That's in 6/8 time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or is it 3/4 time? Or is it 12/8 time?
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time researching that, and I don't know how I could tell 6/8 from 3/4.
Well, 6/8 tends to be faster.
Faster?
Yeah.
But I, you it's know, the like thing, only concrete things I've come away with from this podcast is the fact that how subjective time is. I thought that was absolute. Mm-hmm. And having done all this, I've learned that people will argue about that all the time.
So I got a brief aside about the song.
Well, I just went back four songs. So
This is the first Beatles song that has a Strat on it.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Really?
And it's
who's playing it?
I believe it is Harrison. But here's the deal. So
if anybody can't hear JM's eyes, just let me know. I'll turn it up.
When they started recording this album in early 65, both Lennon and Harrison wanted a Strat. So they sent Mal Evans, who another connection was the guy who brought Badfinger to the band to get him signed on Apple. Mal Evans was the one who found Badfinger. Anyway, he out to get a Strat for them, and he comes back with this matching pair of these Sonic Blue Stratocaster guitars. Those guitars are, this was the first album it was on, but they're used throughout Rubber Soul, all over Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, Magical Mystery Tour. That's the guitar that Harrison paints what do you call it, Rocky, I think, where he paints all the Dayglow colors on it.
Yeah.
That was this guitar he painted over the that Sonic Blue paint job on it. He's the one who did all that stuff.
That's
to
cool.
it. So that's his this is the first song that guitar was on.
Interesting.
Very cool. Now
guitar lovers like me.
Up next we have a song that was made popular by the Carpenters, but the Beatles also did it. Ticket to Ride.
Man, that was hard to press stop on that song.
What the hell's he doing with the drums? It's so amazing.
He's not playing.
It's making you wait. You want this thing to come down, and it's not coming down.
Well, they're also heavier than a typical Beatles song.
Oh yeah,
too.
This was Lennon
this sounds
said.
Like it's from it sounds years like later.
It sounds like off of Revolver.
Well, I was going to say you can hear. There is that beginnings of that psychedelic, quintessential Beatles psychedelic sound.
That opening reminded me immediately of 8 Miles High.
Well, it's
which I mean they ripped off from this, but that's the beginning of that, that sound.
And there's a drone. There's kind of a there drone throughout, and that's the Strat evidently playing the drone throughout.
Oh, really?
What's the drone? I read all about this drone, and I can't figure out. I can't put my finger on it. Is it holding a chord?
I think he's
playing the straight chord through the whole thing, because that whole thing is one.
If chord. Do y'all agree with me that this is the song that jumps out ahead of everything else on the album?
Yeah. This is a remarkable song.
I don't mean it's the best song. I'm just saying it's the future.
It's showing up
on this album.
Here's something that I will. The first time I ever heard it was by the Carpenters.
Me too.
I think I was 8 years old, or I'm probably 7 years old, and just being devastated by it, and then hearing it by the Beatles years later, just going,
"It." I regret that I heard it first from the Carpenters.
I do too. Yeah,
because I had to. It's so stupid now that I think about it. My mom loved the Carpenters.
So did my mom.
And we had one of those big console deals with the speakers and the. It's a piece of furniture that's a stereo.
Right. We had an amazing stereo at my house.
She would just play Gordon Lightfoot and the Carpenters over and over and over again. So when I found out this was a Beatles song, I had to deconstruct everything. And then now I hear it with that opening.
This was the first song that they wrote in this particular way, where they kind of built it in the studio. They started overdubbing and doing layers. And this was obviously, as we talk about first, this was that song that sort of, as you said, you're listening to the future here. This is what's coming.
This is what's coming out. And it doesn't start on the one. It's not, they're not playing on the one. It's not until they go to that,
Paul McCartney was involved in setting up the drums. Is that correct?
I don't know about that. Maybe.
Okay, I don't know.
Lennon calls this their first heavy metal song.
I can kind of see
I think it's
the heaviest song.
If you take out what we know as heavy metal.
Yeah.
I mean, but
it's a 12 string. It's hard to have a 12 string in heavy metal.
Can we agree that the Kinks beat them to that punch, though?
I would say so.
I mean, if they I'd give up on my titles.
But I understand what he's saying, because it's as you said, it's heavier than anything. The drums are going
I hear psychedelic.
But yeah, I do too. This sounds weird.
It's weird, and they don't even know
how. It's that 12-page arpeggio.
I'm so glad that they didn't discover weird sonic stuff before they recorded this, because that would have ruined this song.
And it sounds, one of the things about it is it's dreamlike, and it sounds like it should be. Like the tempo is slightly off, so you're not quite sure what to make of it.
Yeah, he never doesn't come right down on the one every time. Yeah,
I remember being at the Sweet Basil in New York City watching this old jazz band, and my brain just being on a little vacation or something, and this syncopated drums, I don't know what it is doing the same thing. And it is, I think this is the first time in music where this kind of stuff happens. Mm-hmm. But then it starts happening from here to 73 or something. And I love that stuff.
I think it's their discovering the magic of the studio and being able to do this kind of layering thing and do things that they couldn't do just playing a song live or rehearsing the heck out of them and going in the studio and knocking them off.
I feel like I hear a sitar in there.
Oh, there absolutely. There's not one, but it sounds like it.
It's predicting.
Yeah,
it's predicting. Absolutely. It's really predicting. Well, Rev 12 revolver.
String and that drone. You know, that's what a sitar does.
You're right. That drone is.
It is.
You know what
it's predicting a revolver so much.
So there's three sort of meanings involved in this song lyrically. There's the very basic one about this girl sort of discovering her freedom, right?
Yeah. But
then there's, don't let them discover freedom.
And then there's evidently there's a town called Ryde on the Isle of Wight, and McCartney's cousins owned a pub there, and he and Lennon hitchhiked to this place when they were young. So that's also a pun, Ticket to Ryde. But
that's quite cool. the controversial one.
You want to talk about that one, JM?
Well, supposedly it's about living with someone before you're married.
Oh, that's not what I was talking about. You're right.
That didn't happen until the 80s.
No, you're right. That is
it didn't happen until the 80s.
No, that's what the song is. That's this woman exploring her free. That's the kind of point.
Yeah,
but no, what I thought you were going to talk about was Lennon evidently told Don Short, who was a journalist that hung out with him, I think, at the time, that it was in reference to the clean bill of health that the prostitutes in Hamburg had to get before they could go to work.
It was their ticket to ride.
So he says he wasn't sure if Lennon was pulling his leg when he told him that. Lennon said it was their ticket to ride.
All right. Well,
this is one of the best.
Ladies and gentlemen, here at This Is Vinyl Tap, we recommend that all of y'all don't go to Hamburg for those purposes.
So I've got
or Amsterdam.
I've got two other kind of interesting stories about this song. This was the last time they were on Top of the Pops. They were on Top of the Pops performing this song and the B-side. The B-side
of
this song.
Were they playing or did they have to?
No, they had to lip sync.
Oh, God.
But the B-side of this song was Yes, It Is.
I don't know that.
You don't know Yes, It Is? Mm-mm. I feel like I've got to play it now, even though I don't have it up.
Remember what I said. More is true. Yes.
Yes, it is.
So yeah, that's Yes It Is, which was the B side. So they were on Top of the Pops playing that song, and Yes It Is. And part of the archiving rules at the time was the BBC would wipe the footage of this stuff. There's a 30-second clip that survives of their performance, if you want to call it that, their lip singing of the song, because it was included in a Doctor Who episode called The Executioners. And the episode was supposed to feature the Beatles as themselves in the future wearing makeup to look older. But Brian Epstein's like, no, we're not going to do that. So instead, they'd use this clip from Top of the Pops. And that's the only reason that footage survives is because it was in this Doctor Who episode. So that's the first thing I want to talk about.
Yeah, I'm more interested in why they were destroying
old footage. Well, yeah. We will have that clip on the website if anyone's interested in it.
Yeah.
The second interesting thing, and this is another connection loosely, it's a connection with a band, not so much with an album we did, and that's Dark Side of the Moon. Do you know the story about this?
No.
So George Martin did orchestral versions of the songs on Help after the album was released.
So just in case there's someone that's 23.
Doesn't know who George Martin was? Yeah.
George Martin was the producer of the Beatles. He was the one who did a lot of the string arrangements, did a lot of the
he was a serious musician.
Very serious musician.
He was a sessions musician.
Yeah. Very good keyboardist. And
played some of the keyboards on the album we're talking about tonight. Yeah. The good ones.
Anyway, he did orchestral versions of this album. And when Dark Side of the Moon was released in 72 on vinyl, the closing track, Eclipse, if there's a brief snippet of the orchestral version of Ticket to Ride to be heard at the end of that, when the gentleman, I forget what his name is, the guy who's like, I was always crazy at the time, you know, and the heartbeat's going out, you can hear it.
That's cool.
And the reason why was they used the same tape. They, I guess, wiped the tape or something, and they were and using that tape to record, and it was just barely under the mix, but you
really? Can. I love that.
And then when they remastered it, they removed it. But
wow, they should never do that.
I think you can. I'll see if I can find a clip of it online.
If God
I think
puts you can still find previous stuff on your,
well, especially like Ticket to Ride, right?
It reminds me of that thing we talked about with Steve Miller with the noise that the tape makes at the end. Appears in
Fly Like an Eagle.
They didn't know how to.
That's right.
That's that. All right. Ticket to Ride is hard to move on
from. Yeah, right. It's a great way to end the side.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, back in 1965, when Doug Cooper was born, they had albums but had two sides. And you flip it over and you get country music on the other side. Act naturally. Do you know the guy that made this a hit, Tony?
Do I know the guy that made this a hit? Just happens to be my favorite country singer ever.
I can't remember his name. Is it
Buck Owens?
It's Buck Owens?
Yes. Oh. Alvin Edgar Owens, Buck.
Yep. Who is fantastic.
He is.
But
Sherman, Texas.
That's right. That's where we're experts.
Yep.
Sherman, Texas is where my grandfather died. Anyway, everybody's interested in that. If I were Buck Owens and I heard Ringo sing that, I'd be going,
yeah. I mean, that's
pretty darn good.
Well, there are two songs that I always thought were perfect for Ringo Starr. Yellow Submarine and this song.
This song.
Absolutely perfect for his vocal range.
Yeah, well, he nails this.
He does. And he, you know, and George does a pretty decent version of, Don Rich. Not as good.
Look, it's a great song. I love it. I heard this obviously before I heard the Buck Owens version. But when you hear Don Rich play the Telecaster, it's a little difficult to go back to George Harrison playing.
But we don't have a Telecaster with George, do we?
No, we don't.
So he starts out with
inferior Gretsch. Guitar. Yeah,
I think he's playing it.
Somebody reminded me of when that jerk busted into my house and stole my Telecaster. It just still tears me up.
You know, this wasn't the song that was supposed to be on the album by Ringo, right?
I don't know that.
There's a song called If You've Got Trouble, which was unreleased until the anthology disc that came out in the 90s. Uh-huh. And it's a Lennon-McCartney song, and I am going to play you a bit of it.
A little treat for you, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
I like that.
Well, everybody else hated it.
I'm glad he did Act Naturally more, though.
It is routinely considered one of the worst things McCartney and Lennon ever wrote. Harrison even said, it's a weird song, it's got stupid words, and it's a NAFTA song. No wonder it didn't make it onto anything. I mean, Harrison hated
it. It's a NAFTA song?
NAFIST song. Oh, I don't know what is some British
I
term.
I thought it was a North American Free Trade Agreement.
There you go.
That's what I thought. You know, Buck didn't like the song, just a little brief aside.
I bet he did after it started paying his bills.
What happened was Don Rich is walking around the studio after they heard that. So it was written, it wasn't written by either of them. It was written by Johnny Russell. Right.
You know what else he wrote?
What else did he write?
No, nobody asked you, Siri. It's my stupid watch talking.
Johnny Russell write?
Let's fall to pieces.
Oh, really?
Together.
Really?
It's what's his face? I'm supposed to know since I'm a Texan. George Strait.
What happened was Don Rich was walking around the studio and he couldn't stop singing the song, and Buck Owens just recorded it to get him to shut up. and they ended up releasing it in March of 63.
That was his first big hit, wasn't it?
It was number one country, stayed on the charts for 28 weeks. So Ringo says he heard it and he's like, I'm doing this song. And it really is perfect. Yeah. John's not on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's Ringo obviously on lead. McCartney plays the bass, obviously, and does the harmony. And then Harrison does all the other guitar work.
Huh.
So
it is fun.
It's a fun song. They did a good version.
Buck Owens couldn't tell that was a great song. That's bizarre.
Well, Tiger by the Tail.
It sounds.
Tiger by the Tail's great.
It's a great song,
this sounds so much like him.
It does.
I mean, it's hard to imagine him.
So this was the B-side to Yesterday.
Right.
Well,
the same theme and a very different approach.
Here's the funny thing about that. Was when Ringo recorded it, Capitol in the U.S., because Yesterday was, we'll get to it later, Yesterday wasn't ever released as a single. And well, at the time this album came out, it wasn't released as a single. But Capitol released it with Act Naturally as a B-side. But they initially thought Act Naturally was the song. They thought it was the hit on the album. So it's always been listed as, in Capitol's whatever, as the A-side to the single. So when Apple re-released Yesterday later on, or release that single later on in 71 on Apple.
Released Yesterday, Tomorrow.
Act Naturally was the full Apple side of the Apple, and Yesterday was the...
Oh, really?
They sliced it, which was always the B-side because of what Capitol had done.
That's funny.
Yeah.
It is.
I don't know how you hear Yesterday and not think, stop everything. This is a single.
Well, this peaked at number 47, which is not bad for a B-side, I guess.
But you still hear it all the time.
Yeah. No, it was the first... I think I only know one person that heard the Buck Owens version before they heard the Beatles version. And that was my daughter, Grace. And the only reason I'm telling that story
is because she's your daughter, Grace.
She heard the Beatles version afterwards. She goes, they can't do that. That's a Buck Owens song. I've never been
she
prouder.
Is your daughter.
I've never been prouder of my daughter when she said that.
I'd be proud of that myself.
There ought to be a law, Dad.
Yeah, I brainwashed all right. The poor girl.
So, a lot of y'all think this album is almost over, but no. This is back in the day of very short songs, and we have quite a few to go. And the next one is It's Only Love.
I get high when I see you go by. My oh my, when you sigh, my inside just flies. Butterfly, why?
More tambourine.
This is tambourine.
A lot of tambourine album.
That's a nice hat. That was the original title of the song.
Oh, really? That's a nice hat?
That's a nice hat.
I had to check my head, ladies and gentlemen.
I was checking your head, too.
I was looking for a mirror.
I was wondering if he's looking at
me. We're sitting in the Vinegaroon Saloon, and there are a lot of hats in here, and not all of them are appropriate.
This is a good, very, the, this is a complicated song.
You know who hated it?
John Lennon.
John Lennon. Why?
He thinks his lyrics are inane. And I've got to say something. Shut up. A lot of lyrics about love are stupid because love is stupid. It's when your brain turns off and you start oozing feelings all over the place. And once that happens, you switch to feeling. When you switch to feeling, you switch to the music. And this is great music.
It is.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You've got a great chorus. Mm-hmm. You've got a great...
It's got a weird chord progression, too.
It's not simple music. And his voice, again, comes through.
Amazing.
And I think we're at the... This is the stretch where Lennon is pulling the furthest ahead in our box scores over McCarthy.
I agree.
Well, it's...
McCartney.
Not McCarthy. What'd I call
him? McCarthy.
Oh, that's the guy that didn't like the commies, right?
Harrison plays all of the electric guitars. He plays three different electric guitars on this song.
And I think it's part of it's being put through a Leslie cabinet.
Maybe.
Because it's got that rotary sound. Yeah.
You know,
I think this song sounds like a Roger and Hammerstein.
It's a fantastic song.
A song from an American musical.
Yeah.
And that's not a criticism.
Not at all.
Can I say how much I never get tired of the way he says the word bright, where he has that little... Bright thing. I don't know why I love that, but I love it every time he sings.
It's not just that. He has a bunch of these. Oh, things like that. He reminds me of Chrissy Hynde
with her
excels and her expressions. We go.
Yeah, he really does have that.
He has a lot of those and they disappear later.
Yeah.
You know who had a hit with this in 1981?
No.
Gary U.S. Bonds.
Oh, I did know that. Damn it. I have that
really.
I have two of the records right here. It was a hit?
Hit number 43. Well, UK hit. Number 43 in the UK singles chart.
It's, I tell you what I'll say about that. Thank you, Gary U.S. Bonds, for doing that. Because Gary U.S. Bonds never has to go around saying, oh, I'm so deep and meaningful. Because he knows he's never going to be deep and meaningful. Right. He's a rhythm and blues singer. And he nails this song. And he shows... He shows the song for what it's supposed to be. And thank you very much.
I guess Lennon was, you know, more concerned about writing songs like Run for Your Life, which are all about love in his mind, right?
No, I think when you meet Bob Dylan, stuff happens to you.
I guess.
Well, this is another bongo song, too. And it's pretty well done.
Now, it's taking all my energy not to put Gary U.S. Bonds on right now.
Yeah. But I love the guitar part.
It's a good song, and I'm sorry Lennon can't appreciate himself.
Yep.
You like me too much.
I do?
Everyone does. Yep. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. You like me too much.
Though you've gone away this morning, you'll be back again tonight. Telling me there'll be no next time if I just don't treat you right. You'll never leave me and you know it's true. Cause you like me too much and I like you.
I like it.
I like this song. It sounds like I could not believe it was a George Harrison song. It sounds so much like a Paul McCartney song.
You know what it reminds me of? Or what I read this about Harrison's early stuff, and I think it fits this song. And I don't necessarily mean it as an insult, but I think it's just how I feel about it. It sounds like all those bands that tried to sound like the Beatles. It's like he's trying to sound like the Beatles.
Well, I bet they've had an influence on him.
But you know what I mean?
It's a I, me, you song, just like I started out talking about.
Yeah.
I'm so impressed with how strong his voice is. Mm-hmm. And, but it does. I agree with JM. I think it sounds like a Paul McCartney song.
So that beginning part is George Martin playing the electric piano.
It really doesn't fit, but I like the way it's done.
Well, it actually comes back, but at the end of the song, it comes back.
He and McCartney both are playing piano at the end of the song, and then Lennon overdubs that Hofner electric piano
awkward, very awkward.
Yeah,
that part.
It sounded like they were, hey, let's throw George a bone and let's overproduce this song. But it's still a very
it's
a good song.
A song he didn't talk about in his book.
Really?
He didn't like it.
That's amazing. If I'd written this song, I'd be listening to what I was.
Well, I think it goes back to what Doug said about most of the Beatles songs. It's like, yeah, even the bad ones, with the exception of maybe Come Together, you think, man, I wish I'd written that.
Yeah. Never felt that way about Come Together.
That one, or what's the Harrison song on Within You, Without You, or whatever? That's another song I'm not particularly fond of.
Yeah, that's where he's all grooving out with that six-armed lady.
All right. Sorry, I digress.
Well, anyway, this is the next song, another Me, You, I song. Tell Me What You See.
If you let me take your heart, I will prove to you we will never be apart. If I'm part of you, open up your eyes now. Tell me what you see. It is no surprise now. What you see is me.
Ooh, that singing together is fantastic.
Yep, that's the best I can say about this song.
I've got an odd thing to say about this. I love this song, but I was riding around listening to the CD in the car, and this little scratch in my head, this itch, kept saying, this reminds you of something. This reminds you of something. A band that I would have never thought would have been influenced by the Beatles. In fact, I tried to look up to see if there was a connection to this, and I only found one where somebody said, hey, did this have an influence on this song? But I'm going to play you this, because this song, the harmony and the, what's that, the guero?
Oh,
that fish thing.
The fish thing, yeah.
Reminds me.
This has that.
No, the claves aren't that. That's a clay. This is a it's G-U-I-R-O. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Guero.
Yeah. So that reminds me of of this.
It's not going to be Super Tramp, is it?
No, that's next week. Okay.
It's a buck dancer's
job. Little Grateful Dead, ladies and gentlemen.
I kept hearing Uncle John's Band when I was hearing that song.
Wow.
It was
weird. Now I can't hear it. Now I'm not going to be able to unhear that.
It wasn't just it wasn't just that fishy thing. It's the harmony. It's because it's unusual harmony for the Beatles. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, what does this remind me of? It's Uncle John's Band.
I didn't know that the Beatles ever heard Grateful Dead.
Well, no, I never thought the Dead would have been I guess everybody was influenced by the Beatles, but there's no way that song.
I can't believe that.
That's like, that's, it's even subconscious.
That's worth listening to this whole boring podcast for. I like that song a lot.
It's a great song.
It's not one of my favorites.
How can it be? I mean, we're talking about this fantastic lineup.
To me, it sounds, it's a little, Lennon is so far ahead of McCartney at this point. There's just nothing that's really grabbing me about McCartney songs until
the next two.
Until the next
I mean, I'm giving Paul at least a 4 on that one.
So
I've got Lennon ahead at this point also.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a little bit like Abbey Road, where Paul just starts making up ground at the end.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Does Lennon get discounted points for Come Together? He should get like minus points or something.
He should get minus. I love the guitar part. I just love the
Aerosmith.
I love Come Together, but I'm a bass player, so
well, the bass part's in it. So Doug, you might get a kick out of this. evidently hanging on the wall in Lennon's childhood home, the one he shared with his aunt and his uncle, were these lines. However black the clouds may be, in time they'll pass away. Have faith and trust, and you will see God's light make bright your day. And these are the lines from Tell Me What You See. Big and black the clouds may be, time will pass away. If you put your trust in me, I'll make bright your day.
So he just substituted himself for God.
I guess so, yeah.
Oh, well, that's nice. I need to write the 23rd Psalm over again. All right. I think we're about to hear some people express themselves way too much.
I'll be good.
I've just seen a face.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just a girl for me, and I want all the world to see we've met. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way, and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight. Falling, yes, I'm falling.
Okay.
He made up big ground right here.
This is a damn near perfect song.
It is.
This is, if you're John, you and your boys are thinking you're about to take it into the showers. We've got this one, boys. Let's take it on in. And this comes out, and oh crap.
Yeah.
This is like six runners on the field getting knocked in at once. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're from another country, you can only get three runners on the field. This is just from outer space. This is a hoedown. I don't know what we're listening to.
We've got the coolest intro,
and we've got this powerful
it's
Paul McCartney voice.
Yeah.
And
there's no bass on this song.
No. And it doesn't need anything. And
it doesn't need anything.
It's got one of the most awkward leads on an acoustic guitar and that you ever hear, and it works perfect.
It's got that irregular rhyming scheme with it, yep, too. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. This song, and
I've never seen anyone play a song more confidently than he does with Wings when he does this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He knows he's all right.
So
this is so good. You're just going to have to sit there and listen.
Well, and the harmony, there's so many places you can take it, and it's...
And it's not a hit.
Which I cannot understand how this
is. But it makes me like it more because it's kind of like my personal little Beatles song.
And I can just see, I don't know how old he would have been at 65. Not super young.
I think he's 23.
I'm not talking about McCartney. McCartney was 22 or 23 when he wrote this. I'm talking about somebody who obviously heard this and was influenced by it, and that's Paul Simon.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you could just, I don't know how young he would have been when this came out. Not super young, because he heard this and he's like, oh.
This is what I'm supposed to do.
This is what I'm, yeah, exactly.
Well, the thing is, it's like,
it's funny you said that, because every time I hear that song, I think Paul Simon.
I do too. I thought if you had told me this was Paul Simon had written this song, I would have said it's a Paul Simon song. But
say, John, Paul does a great job with Paul's song.
the thing about it is, like, it's familiar, but
it doesn't sound British.
It doesn't sound British, but is there another, think of another song like it?
No, I give up.
So, you know,
it almost sounds bluegrassy, but it's not.
Well, it's definitely country influence, but we talked about the fact they were doing that. This song replaced Taxman.
Rubber Soul.
Rubber Soul. So Taxman was taken off, and this started off Rubber Soul, which gave that album a much more acoustic kind of folky feel.
Yeah.
Taxman comes out with all kinds of distortion and angry guitars. Yeah. And,
I just think that's interesting that on the U.S. label they did that. They left this song off of, well, obviously because it was a soundtrack album. They did it, but they stuck it on.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yep.
What's the he does some weird casual stuff while recording this, like a little mouth trumpet and some other weird things.
It's obvious they're having a fun time playing this song.
Yeah, it's...
It's impossible not to have a good. I've played this song in so many bands.
It's a fun song to play because it's fast and
upbeat.
But it sounds like it's in a minor key, and it's not.
No.
And it sounds serious and almost like he's attacking someone, and it's fun. It's just a bunch of contradictions together.
And for some reason, I like the fact that it's called I've Just Seen a Face.
Yeah.
And that's not the chorus or anything. It's just the name of the song because it's the first thing he says.
It's like a hymn in the hymnal. It's the first line. Yeah.
So
anyway,
great song.
That's your favorite song on the album, Tony?
No, my favorite song is Ticket to Ride. This is a very, very, very close second.
This is my second favorite song.
It's my favorite.
It was his aunt.
Yesterday should be my favorite, but it's not foreign enough to be sexy. Well,
and I wonder, I think
it's like a sister.
I know we're gonna talk about it next, but I wonder if it doesn't suffer a little bit from being so familiar.
That's what I just said. Anybody who had been listening to me rather than thinking about their next sentence would have heard that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you say that. I thought you said it's like a little sister.
Who's way too familiar.
Oh. I didn't.
That's
I didn't,
how that works.
I didn't get that. Okay, sorry.
In species,
I was listening to you. I just didn't understand what you were saying. It happens sometimes.
I don't believe them. All right. So everyone agrees that's a fantastic song. Mm-hmm. And if anyone doesn't like that song, they're a horrible person.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, Yesterday.
Yesterday. All my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
That is not conventional guitar playing.
No.
That's thumb hitting things real heavy.
He's not. I've saw a guy today talk about how Paul McCartney plays guitar, or acoustic guitar anyway, and he uses two fingers, which is the Merle Travis way of playing guitar. I did not know this. He was influenced by Merle Travis guitar playing. And so when he plays with, of course, he's left-handed. So, but.
you know, the audience can't see what you're ladies and gentlemen, JM just demonstrated using the left hand
because he was using his right
hand. I was using my right hand. But yeah, so he has a style where a lot of people would be using three fingers to kind of do an arpeggio thing. He just kind of does a
boom, ching, boom, ching, 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 ching,
boom, ching.
It works very well.
Very well on this.
I'm so glad he's so confident to tell everybody else to let me do this.
Even though he's a bass player.
So we mentioned this before. This is the first song to have strings in any Beatles song.
The first one to just have one guy.
First one to have. And that was a bit of a bone of contention because McCartney says he brought it to the band and they're like, we can't add any. All of them is like, we can't really add anything to this.
That's should to do their
credit. George Martin said, to me, this has, it requires strings. And we don't want that Monteverdi rubbish.
Well, and the funny thing about that was George Martin went back to
Epstein.
Yeah, thank you, Brian Epstein, and said, this really ought to be a solo record. And Brian Epstein is like, we're not giving any indication that the Beatles aren't a band. Absolutely not. And so they put it on there. But because of that, as much as I think all the guys in the band were like, holy cow, they didn't want to release it as a single because it wasn't a Beatles song. It was a Paul McCartney song. So it wasn't released as a single in the UK. It was released as a single in the US, but not in the UK.
And now it's the most covered song in the history of...
I can tell you a gazillion people who covered White Christmas, but I really...
I can't tell you.
I don't know if they cover it and it goes into some memory hole that no one ever hears from again.
Well, I've got a couple of samples of songs if you want to hear
them. Tony, do you have any samples?
Yeah.
Play Black Sabbath.
Here's one. I wish Black Sabbath did.
Oh, God.
Here's one.
Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe yesterday, suddenly.
So we all know who that is. Connection.
Yeah. I believe I already said that I should have had the job of stopping that.
Yes, please.
Okay, here's another one.
Why did she have to go? I don't know. She wouldn't say. But wait a minute. I said
Another connection.
Is that
it's Ray Charles.
Oh God.
And then
I've never not recognized Ray Charles before.
I have neither. Wilson Pickett.
Here's the last one I'm gonna play, another connection.
Aretha. That's not so bad. That's my favorite out of the three.
If they could uncover her, they had too much stuff.
I wish I had thought of finding the Molly Hatchet one before we did this, because that would be interesting.
Well, we'll put that on the website.
I'm just going to offer up free advice for anybody out there. It's been done. Stop. Yeah. Don't do this. Don't do Over the Rainbow. It's done.
Merle and Willie actually did a duet of it. Kind of the
that
opposite.
Doesn't make any sense. Like they're missing each other, like they just broke up.
You're hurting me.
So here's what's interesting about Lennon's comments on this song. He said all the lines were nice lines, but the song doesn't resolve itself. And I think he's kind of missing the point of the song by saying
damn right.
That.
That's the way I heard him say that, and I wanted to kick it, but I wasn't able to. Yeah. These kind of things, these situations, John, they don't revolve themselves. That's why they're tragic, and that's why you're sad, and that's why you listen to a sad song. Yeah. It's not like...
And by the way, she came back, and I'm happy.
Everything's fine.
So tomorrow's going to be better.
It's not Star Trek, where everybody's chuckling around the captain's chair at the end of the show.
Now I'm happy for tomorrow.
Here's another tribble.
I mentioned that it was a UK or US single. It was number one for 4 weeks on the Billboard single chart and spent 11 weeks.
That's New Zealand.
Spent 11 weeks on the chart selling a million copies within the first 5 weeks.
Well, the thing is that this thing had more than probably 1,200 cover versions in 10 years. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got 2,200 plus right now.
Think about this for a minute. The Beatles last for how many studio albums? 12? Somewhere around that?
I think it was less than that.
I think less than that.
Okay. Anyway, call us up and tell us.
This was the fifth one.
But think about the fact that...
It might have been 12.
Think about the faces.
Mm-hmm.
You had that one extraordinary singer.
Nazo Wink.
And a good songwriter. Yeah. And it couldn't handle it. But in the Beatles, you had a little balance provided by John and Paul, and they're just, and they know they've got this great thing. I wonder if one of those guys had been missing, if this thing would have flung out of orbit earlier.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
I don't know. That's a really good
question. It's kind of like us with our enormous popularity. If there were not three of us to keep ourselves balanced, what would have happened?
Yeah, I'm going to do my own podcast.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's very ethereal of you.
I wonder if anybody will listen to this one except for us. we've enjoyed it, ladies and gentlemen.
So I've got two more things I want to say about this song. Chuck Berry said he wished he'd written this song. Lennon says he didn't, which is a
BS. I wish I'd written this song.
Who
does it?
Lennon.
He's so full of crap.
And then I don't know if this ever resolved. I didn't look it up to see if she changed her mind. But in 2001, McCartney went to Yoko and said, "Can we change the order of the writing credits on this to McCartney Lennon?" And she refused at that point to do it. She may have acquiesced. I can't remember if she did or not. But
I think she did acquiesce, but they just decided that Paul McCartney.
I don't understand Paul asking for that, and I don't understand her.
I agree with you. It seems like a silly thing for him to. Yeah.
Nobody doesn't know. If somebody doesn't know that he wrote this, they don't matter.
I mean,
yeah. Well, I saw McCartney in concert when he was saying that the benefit of Mr. Kite was always credited to Lennon. He goes, "No, I was there. I helped write it," and he goes, "All right, so why are you telling us that?"
Lennon's not around to disagree with that, but I bet you that's BS.
It sounds 100% like Lennon.
Yeah.
But who cares? I mean, how many songs, if you've written as many songs as Paul McCartney has,
maybe he was worried about his royalties from when Michael Jackson owned the songbook for so long.
I mean, I just, God. I don't understand. I mean, JM and I have written some songs together, and we've never once
What's the order? Is it Roe Cooper or Cooper Roe?
We haven't even settled that, have we?
I haven't figured that out yet, no.
But
should call it Crooper.
Crooper music. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Anyway, it's since none of them have made a dime, it's really easy for us to get along. All right. Y'all ready to wrap this sucker up?
Yeah.
Yep.
I wish we didn't have to.
Yes.
Again, not
Dizzy a... Miss Lizzie.
Yeah, not a bad song, just...
Not necessary.
Okay, this goes to my point earlier.
It does. it does. I was thinking when I was listening to that, it said, this is what JM was saying. This song sounds irrelevant now because of what came before it on this album.
Yeah. And Lennon's voice is good, but then that ow at the beginning of it just sounds so contrived. It doesn't sound like anything.
It doesn't come out as organic as Postman and Twist and Shout does.
Yeah.
It sounds like, oh, yeah, let me try it one more time.
But even their version of Twist and Shout, compare that to the Isley Brothers version of it. They've introduced Arthur Alexander, you know, go with him. That's a great song. And the Arthur Alexander version is so much better. They did a great job of introducing people to great artists.
They did.
But they just can't. They can't pull it off. In my opinion, they just can't pull it off.
So, just some background. This was written by Larry Williams.
It's a great, and his song is
fantastic. He does a great job recording it.
Yeah. Piano based.
They've been playing it live forever. I almost feel like this was added on because the rest of the band was like, we can't end with Yesterday. I don't know why they felt that way other than the fact that it was a solo McCartney song, but I have a feeling that they're like, we got to put something upbeat and rocky on the end of the album. And so they added this.
To me, it sounded like they could have had this be the credits, but you know how like a lot of like Rolling Stones will have movies and stuff where at the end of it, they won't do their song at the end of it. Like, they could have just done Larry Williams and over the credits of the end of this.
But this wasn't even in the movie.
It wasn't. No. This just feels like an afterthought. Like it's tacked on. It does not, the rest of the album.
It's my question was, and I say this all the time, what's this for?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Why?
It's,
and it doesn't do anything different, right?
If I'm at a concert and they want to do this, I'm going to dig that.
If there's history of the Beatles.
I want to say, all right, I'm digging it. I'm at a Beatles concert and Lennon's letting it go.
Right.
But
and they bring him upstairs or up on stage to play the piano with them, Larry Williams.
For an album?
It's really the only miss on this whole album.
It is.
It's weird because it's a really
good miss.
It is.
If you're gonna miss,
it's a good miss. Yeah,
because Lennon's voice is fantastic.
Yeah, I think we all
there's energy there, and
yeah,
but it is like you're sleeping on your grandmother's couch, and it's 4:30 in the morning, and she comes in, and starts cooking pancakes, and turns all the lights on. You just listened to Yesterday, and now this? I mean, my gosh, leave me alone. I just heard Yesterday. Why do I have to do with Miss Lizzie, whoever the hell she is? I was in love with this person, and she's gone, and Miss Lizzie, whoever the hell she is.
It's a great song, and it was the original version is fantastic.
But I don't think it's a great song. I think it's a little throwaway rocker. That was fun when
I think I like stuff from this
era. I do too. And a lot of it's just fun.
Yeah.
Boogie woogie music, but it's not a monumental songwriting achievement.
No, but you're right. But that again goes to my point. It's
and the guitar is obnoxious.
Yeah, guitar does not.
It is good. Obnoxious. You're absolutely right.
Bam, no, 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 no.
Yeah, yeah. Twist and Shout is. It's at the bottom end, and you're getting to fill it in your. You get your groove going, and then this great John Lennon singing happens. Uh-huh. You remember what's that bratty kid that did that Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
when he's up there pretending he's Lennon singing it. I mean, Lennon's voice is so fantastic on that song, and it's fantastic on this song. But the song doesn't get out of the way of his voice.
He plays a Vox Continental on this song.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just to throw that out, because we've talked about that in the past.
Oh, yeah. That's
Vox made guitars?
No, organ. It's an organ.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So one where the keyboards are the I knew they keys made keys are white and the white keys are black.
Yeah, it's the one that the guy that's from clever. The Attractions plays, right?
Yeah. It's the one that's played on Refugee by Tom Petty.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of a very fine album. Jonathan Jambro, at this time of the evening, we usually give our album. This is an unusual situation, ladies and gentlemen. This is an album that no one picked. It's a 100th anniversary episode rating. And Jonathan Jambro, you're up first.
All right. So I'm glad we're doing this.
I'm glad that you're glad.
There's the Red Album by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Album by the Beatles. Their greatest hits that came out fairly soon after they disbanded. I am much a... So if you were to delineate like which songs came on the Blue or which albums came... What songs came off of the Blue...
You're a Blue Album guy.
I'm a Blue Album guy is the thing to say. So this is definitely a Red Album. So I'm going to say... Of the Red albums, this is your favorite Red album. This is my second favorite off the Red album.
Rubber Soul is your favorite Red album.
Rubber Soul is my favorite, and I think that Rubber Soul is more cohesive than this. That's not to say that I think this is a not cohesive album. I think it's surprisingly cohesive. And one of the things I think that actually it benefits from is the 2008 remaster that I've been listening to. It sounds much clearer. There's so many more things that come out on it from when I remember listening to it in the past. So that's not to say it's a unfine album, but this from its era, I'm really my second favorite album from then. So I'm going to give my cold-hearted critic rating first, 4.5. It suffers from the final song. Sounds like it was a little bit cobbled together, even though I do think that it's more cohesive than I remember it being. But yeah, 4.5. My personal rating is going to be a 4.0 because what I just talked about. It's really hard for me to not compare this album to albums by them, you know, post 1965.
Even though this came out in 1965,
post 1965,
I can't believe doing both of those in one year
because Revolver and everything.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Sorry, okay. I'll shut up, everybody.
All right, so everything that came the thing when I listen to the Beatles, the stuff that I'm much more intrigued by is the stuff post Rubber Soul, and I think that the songs became just much more interesting, and the Beatles themselves became much more interesting. I don't really listen to the songs for the Beatles prior to that for any sort of emotional connection or anything. That said, listening to this album has been really, really good for me because I never really have paid that much attention to the Beatles albums prior to this. And this has been... You know, Rubber Soul, besides Rubber Soul. So.
All right. Yeah. Well, since nobody picked this album, I'm going to go next because I know that T is the biggest Beatles fan. And if somebody had have picked this album, it would have been T. I'm going to give this a 4.8 on my personal opinion. And Dizzy Miss Lizzy helps bring it down a little bit. There's a time where I feel a separation from the Beatles because they're so perfect and so elegant that I feel like they don't even know who I am.
You want a slight flaw.
I want something.
You want to humanize them.
I want something to humanize them.
Yeah.
My critic's pick is 5, and the reason I give it a 5 is because, no duh, it's obviously a 5. If this isn't a 5, okay, go give me a Beethoven 7th symphony, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a 5. T?
Yeah.
How about you, man?
So, I may surprise you a little bit. Personally, this is a 5 for me. This is my favorite Beatles album. It's funny, somebody asked me that years ago, and I had to think about it, and I started looking at the songs or whatever, and I'm the opposite of you, JM. When I was younger and dumber, that's JM is now. That's a joke. I loved later Beatles stuff, but as I've grown older, my favorite era is the early stuff. I think it's some of the greatest music ever.
That's your power pop side coming.
Well, you can say that, but the power pop I listen to doesn't exist without the second side of Abbey Road. It just doesn't. I mean, that's just the fact. But yeah, I'm a sucker for that 60s rock and roll that I think they play, that 60s kind of pop rock that they play. I love it. A band I recommended early on, the Night Sobs, I think encapsulates that sound perfectly in the modern era. Yeah. So this is a 5 personally for me. I'm gonna do the opposite of Doug. I'm not gonna give a 4.8 critically, but I'm gonna give it a 4.9, I think, because Dizzy Miss Lizzy. So I'm a critic. I'm looking at going, this album, even some of the weaker songs are cohesive, and then you get to the very last one, and it's like someone's, you know, pulled that brake on the bus or the train and made it stop. Not a bad song, again, but I just think it knocks it down critically a little bit. But that's it. I'm long-winded. I apologize, but that's my take.
We've had longer-winded than that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for 100 episodes. I need to probably say that just because we've recorded 100 episodes doesn't mean that you've listened to 100 episodes. But
we've actually recorded more than that.
Yeah, but I'm talking about strict reviews.
Our lane.
Studio albums.
What we do, right.
So what we would like you to do is to tell a whole bunch of other people to listen to this podcast. If you don't like this podcast, we'd like you to continually download it and not listen to it. But what we'd like to do at this time is go to Tony for a recommendation.
Yeah, Doug, I'm just going to make this quick. There's a book that was written, I'm not sure when it was written, several years ago, called A Hard Day's Right. And it's a deep dive into every single song that the Beatles wrote. Their history, their backgrounds, it's divided up by album.
Oh, wow.
And it's great. I got it for Christmas years ago. I used it, obviously, for research for this.
Well,
it
would have been helpful for him to share that with us, I guess, Jim.
I love it. Well, the other thing I found, and I'll just toss this out too, there's a website called The Beatles Bible, which is a fantastic website with all sorts of intricate trivia stuff. Like, stuff I've never even heard of. It puts me to shame. Not that I'm the biggest Beatles fan in the world, but I feel like I know a lot. But yeah, Hard Day's Right, by a gentleman named Steve Turner. There'll be a link to find it someplace on the website. But if you're interested in like getting into that, kind of digging into what the song's about and the sort of around the history around it, it's a fantastic book.
All right, Tony, we appreciate that very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we really appreciate you listening to us. It has been a pleasure putting these episodes together and doing the research and listening to the music most of the time. And we really appreciate you appreciating the long player format. And if you know of anyone who does...
The long talker format.
And the long talker. If you know of anyone who appreciates the album format, please let them know about this podcast. Let them know where they can get us. We're on any podcasting platform. You can also go up there, leave us some stars, leave us a review, let people know what you think. We'd really appreciate it. Also, you can reach us on our Facebook group page, and you can email us oldschool@tappingvinyl@gmail.com. And for the ultimate, this is Vinyl Tap experience. You can visit our website at www.tappingvinyl.com. You'll find all sorts of good stuff up there. Links to past episodes, ways to get in contact with us, ways to leave us reviews, links to videos, recommendations, all sorts of stuff. So highly recommend you go up there. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer for the 100th time, this is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11.